Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Debt and deficit on the broadcast today, why they matter, or do they? Why your office PC is always so far behind, and why Gallup polls turn out the way they do. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace podcast for Thursday, the 25th of October. Good to have you with us. There was quite the crowd at the New York Stock Exchange this morning for the ringing of the opening bell. A high-profile, or maybe I should say another high-profile effort to focus attention on how much money we owe, we as in all of us, households, governments, and companies. A group called the Campaign to Fix the Debt got to ring the bell at the big board today and got a bunch of big-name CEOs to sign on to a public manifesto calling for Congress and the president to do something about that debt. Felix Salmon blogged about it all today for Reuters. Hey, Felix.
Hi, Kai.
You are not kind to these corporate titans. You call them self-serving. You all but say they were grandstanding with this manifesto.
They were. They are trying to reduce their own taxes in the guise of some great public self-interest. It's kind of disgusting, really.
When was the last time a CEO had a manifesto, anyway?
It's a good question. Aren't they meant to be making the economy grow rather than meddling in self-interested politics?
Do you disagree with the basic premise that we have a lot of debt and they want to stabilize it and eventually bring it down?
Yes. Really? The U.S. federal deficit is high right now.
Yeah.
It's not unprecedentedly high. We can deal with it, especially because interest rates are so low, it isn't costing us very much. The total amount of debt in the country is actually coming down. It has been coming down ever since the crisis. So we're moving in the right direction in terms of total debt to GDP in this country.
Key phrase there, right? It's when you talk about total debt in this country, which it's public debt, that is the federal debt, and also private debt, that is these companies. And you point out that these companies are deleveraging, they are shedding debt, and so the government is stepping up to borrow.
It's the companies and it's households as well. So you and I probably have lower credit card bills now than we did 5 years ago. And the companies, when they borrow less, and they are borrowing less, what that means is that there's less economic activity going on. And the government is stepping in with its own borrowing to try and keep the economy moving in the context of a corporate sector, these CEOs, who are not doing what they should be doing. What they should be doing is taking advantage of these low interest rates to borrow money and invest in the economy. And they're not doing that.
Yeah, to their credit, they do say in this thing that any solution to the deficit in this country has to be bipartisan, which you read as meaning you got to talk about revenues, raising taxes, as well as cutting benefits.
And they do talk about raising revenues when they talk about this thing called broadening the base.
Yeah.
But that's exactly the kind of revenues that you and I want to be scared of, because broadening the base is going back to when Mitt Romney said that 47% of Americans don't pay federal income tax. They're saying, yeah, we should have more people paying federal income tax. They pay federal income tax already. They want their tax rate to go down. They just want more people to pay taxes, the middle classes and the lower middle classes and the poor.
This is not the only we got to fix the debt advocacy group out there, right? So are you maligning all of them or just these guys?
All of them, pretty much. Both parties, the Democrats and the Republicans, and the public, and the debate moderators, and everyone seem to have convinced themselves, with no particular reason, that the national debt is this massive problem that we need to deal with urgently.
If not the debt and the deficit, what should we be concentrating on as the real economic threat?
Unemployment. We don't have enough people working in this country. We need to get the unemployment rate down. We need to get the employment rate up. We need to create millions and millions of jobs. That's priority number one. The debt is way behind.
Felix Salmon, he blogs at Reuters. He's with us every now and then on a Friday afternoon for the Weekly Wrap. Felix, thanks a bunch.
Thank you.
Strong start, blah finish at the corner of Wall Street and Broad today. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We'll be right back. you get yourself all up to speed in your private high-tech life. You've got the newest smartphone, a tablet, and an ultralight laptop. All your music and documents float safely up in the cloud. You get the idea. And then you go to work. You get to the office, and it's like time stands still. Vintage Blackberries, bulky desktops. Your PC is running a version of Windows that is two generations or more behind. Speaking of which, Microsoft rolls out Windows 8 tomorrow, the most innovative thing that company's made in years. But other companies, oh, they're not in any rush to sign on, as Marketplace's Queen of Kim explains.
I switched to the iPhone a couple years ago, and at home, I ditched Microsoft Word for Google Docs. And when I did it, I didn't let anybody know. I just did it. It's not that easy for companies, including the one I work for. Brad Rosenberger is the director of IT at American Public Media, Marketplace's parent company.
I'll give you an example of that. In the case of our financial applications, the financial vendors that you work with have to support that OS.
By OS, he means operating system. And by financial vendors, Rosenberger means the software companies that help us keep our books and cut our checks. And then there's the software that lets us produce radio stories.
And sometimes it can take a year or two before those vendors provide the support necessary for a new OS.
These are just a few of the reasons why American Public Media is only now making the switch to Windows 7. Chris Silva is an analyst at the Altimeter Group. He predicts
a small percentage of enterprises that use Windows
will switch to Windows 8. Windows 8 runs on both tablets and desktops. And so Microsoft is betting that one day when consumers want to ditch laptops for tablets, well, here's our IT director, Brad Rosenberger.
They're really trying to hit the consumer, hit the executive, and get them to bring these devices in, tell their IT departments, this is what I want to use now. It's running Windows.
And Rosenberger says that when the CEO comes knocking, we'll probably make the switch to Windows 8. I'm Queen of Kim for Marketplace.
A lot of things are shrinking in the airline business right now. Seats, legroom, overhead space, free food, free anything for that matter. Turns out, though, even airline routes are shrinking. Singapore Airlines yesterday announced it's 86ing the two longest flights in the world, Singapore to L.A. and Singapore to Newark. Other airlines have been canceling some of their super long hauls as well. Stacey Vanek-Smith takes a look now at why going the distance just isn't worth it.
Everything about super long haul flights is big. The distances, usually more than 8,000 miles. That's at least 15 hours. The planes, they hold hundreds of passengers and tens of thousands of gallons of fuel, which is part of the problem.
Carrying a lot of fuel costs a lot of money.
Aviation consultant Michael Boyd.
The cost of carrying the fuel you need to go nonstop Singapore, New York gets exorbitant.
Especially when the cost of jet fuel soars, like it's done in the past year. Airline analyst Henry Hardeveld says in addition to fuel, super long-haul flights have to have extra crew to relieve the long shifts.
These ultra-long-haul routes are ultra-premium for a very, very time-sensitive customer, and the operating costs are substantially higher than normal.
So why do airlines even have super long-haul flights? Ticket price. $7,000 to $10,000 per round trip, says aviation analyst Richard Apolafia.
People will pay extra to fly directly, especially the people in the front of the cabin who supply about 95% of an airline's profits.
Which is why Apolafia expects super long haul flights will make a comeback. He says new jumbo jets from Airbus and Boeing are more fuel efficient and could be enough to make the long flights worth the haul. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek-Smith for Marketplace.
Bankers, it turns out, are being laid off, and in droves, too. Barclays, Deutsche Bank, Goldman Sachs, and Credit Suisse have all launched big redundancy programs the past couple of weeks. Marketplace's Stephen Beard has been following the fortunes of three ex-bankers in London, the city, to see how they're faring out in the real world.
Say what you like about investment bankers, but they're usually fast on their feet.
One, two, three. One, two, three. Forward, side, together. Back, side.
A beginner's head. Class at one, Dance Buzz, two, a dance three, school born one, out of the financial two, crisis. Natalia Grigorova set up the school after she quit her banking job. She jumped before she was pushed.
They were ringing people on the phone and they were telling them to go to the fifth floor, and then they never returned from the fifth floor. So this is how it was all happening. It's just not one of the best feelings in the world.
Watch it once. Slow, slow, quick, quick, slow.
Natalia admits that setting up her school has been a struggle. She makes less money now, but at least she feels she's doing something useful.
Exactly. It's definitely socially useful. And
investment banking isn't.
Isn't.
More than 100,000 people have left London's financial centre since the crisis began. Many were bankers, among them Andy Moffat. Once a Eurozone government bond trader, he's now providing London with a different kind of liquidity.
We can make, every time we brew, round about 3,000 pints. Typically, we brew about four times a week, so we make about 12 to 15,000 pints every week.
In this small industrial unit in North London, Andy has set up the Redemption Microbrewery. So named, he says, because the enterprise is saving his life.
I wanted to run my own business, feel like I had control over my life, and I just wanted to be able to go home and think, you know what, I am in control of my destiny, and that's what having your own business and making something is all about.
He makes significantly less money now, but claims he has a much more satisfying life as a brewer, building a brand, making something real. He's not the only ex-banker to deplore some of the products peddled by their old industry.
Synthetic products, you know, instruments that traders trade with each other that are so far removed from the daily kind of business that they seem to serve no social function.
28-year-old Anil Stocker also jumped ship and with friends set up a business called Market Invoice, bringing finance to small and medium-sized enterprises. He now makes less than half what he made as a hotshot banker, but he's not complaining.
What we like about our company is that we help a business, we see them recruit people, we see them deliver products overseas, and we can say we're really helping.
Triple step, rock step, bring her out, and rock step. Leave
dancing, brewing, step, financing step, small business, and for less money. The former high flyers have come down to earth with a bit of a bump. They all say they gained valuable experience in their former careers, but now at least they don't have the social embarrassment of admitting they're bankers.
Now I'm an ex-banker, so that makes me look good in people's eyes. I've left that terrible place that banking is.
And that, they would argue, is a real bonus. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Coming up,
Amazon's always been very interested in becoming a utility, a backbone, so pervasive it's everywhere.
First National Bank of Amazon, anybody? But first, let's do the numbers. Markets couldn't hold on to their early morning rally today. The Dow Industrials gained just 26 points, 0.2%, finished at 13,103. The Nasdaq inched up 4 points, 0.1%, 29.86. At the bell, the S&P 500 also rose 4 points. 0.3%, settled at 14.12. United Continental Holdings slumped 5% today. World's biggest airline announced lower profits. You can blame that on a combination of falling revenues and rising operating costs. Sprint Nextel sliced off 1.7%. The number three wireless carrier reported a loss of subscribers. Best Buy slid 10% with news it's cut its revenue outlook for the year. The New York Times, a gray day for the gray lady. It fell nearly 22%. After reporting sluggish advertising revenue. Home builders gave back their gains from yesterday. Pulte Group declined 2.5%. Toll Brothers shed nearly 3% today. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year Treasury rose to 1.83%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. In Washington, the Commerce Department releases its advance estimate, gross domestic product report for the third quarter. It's Hillary Rodham Clinton's birthday. The Secretary of State will be 65. And on October 26, 1984, The Terminator opened on the big screen. It depicted a futuristic world ruled by an artificial intelligence network. Imagine that. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The housing news of late has been good, both in the macro sense, the general vibe, and in the specific statistical sense. But hang on just a second, because most of us have to borrow money to buy a house, and new mortgage regulations in the Dodd-Frank financial reform law might make that a little bit tricky. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer has the story.
One of the new rules would require lenders to look at whether a loan is affordable and whether the borrower has the resources to repay it. The other spells out when banks have to keep a stake in risky mortgages they're selling to investors.
We see mortgage rules as they're proposed as being problematic.
That's Charlie Dawson. He's a lobbyist with the National Association of Realtors. He says the new regulations could be so strict that banks would shy away from any risk, constricting credit even more.
Only the ultra-safe, pristine mortgages are going to be made.
Elise Cohen is an attorney at the National Consumer Law Center. She says you can't blame the credit crunch on tighter regulations.
We have a credit shortage now because the lack of regulation destroyed the international economy. It was exactly this lack of regulation that caused the foreclosure crisis.
There are voices in the middle of this debate.
There's no doubt about it. The mortgage market is broken.
Susan Wachter is one of them.
And we need rules to put it back together. But ideally, we should have rules that put it back together in a form that worked and worked for decades.
Wachter teaches real estate at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School. She says new regulations are needed, but some pre-housing crisis rules should stay, with lower down payments than Dodd-Frank would require and more tolerance for a ding or two on an applicant's credit report. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
I'd admit it, with the election less than 2 weeks away and it looking to be of the photo finish variety, come on, you're watching the polls, aren't you? Well, if you are, you might have noticed that last week Gallup had Governor Romney ahead by a good deal more than most others did. We happen to know a guy who works at Gallup. Frank Newport is the editor-in-chief there. So that is what we're going to talk about today, polling and its disparities. Frank, it's good to have you here.
Good to be with you.
The numbers you guys had a week or so ago, Frank, about Governor Romney being up plus seven, they were somewhat distant from I guess you could call consensus polling, and I get that you don't want everybody to have the same poll, but why were you guys at plus seven when nobody else was?
Well, there were other polls, by the way, out at the same time that showed Romney ahead. There was one other poll by George Mason University that also had it seven, so it wasn't like it was the only poll there. But it was based on our large sample interviewing 3,500 people, and that's what they told us. We showed definitely Romney doing very well as an example in the South. We showed him doing disproportionately well among men. We showed him actually cutting into the lead that Obama has among postgraduates. And we put all that together. The sentiments of the people we interviewed just tilted somewhat more towards Romney than it had a week before that when it was closer to being even, or what we have today when it's also closer to being even.
You know who Nate Silver is, right?
Yes.
Okay. He is a young, reasonably well-known numbers and statisticians guy. He's written a book about statistics and predictions. We had him on the show a week or two ago. He had a big piece in the New York Times this past Sunday. Not at all kindly disposed toward Gallup. He had a lot of criticisms. I want to talk about just one of them, and that is what he saw as wild swings you guys had in the last election, the 2008 election, and how widely you missed the mark. How do you respond?
Well, I don't think we missed the mark widely. Our estimate in 2008 that he's talking about was exactly the same as his New York Times estimate, by the way. Our polls were the same in 2008, so his own poll was that way. And I think we were not off in previous elections as well. Swings, well, it's what we were talking about. I think there are moves in the election. If we didn't have swings, we wouldn't track. We've gone to a seven-day rolling average now in part to kind of iron out some of those short-term variations, but trust me, this is the sixth election I've been involved in. I just think there are ups and downs, particularly in the last month of an election.
Do we need to know where this race is every day?
Well, you know, speaking of the New York Times, I had a piece in there a week or two ago where they said, what would the world be like without polls, horse race polls in particular? So that's a good question. You know, a lot of people say, why do we need all the polling? Why don't we just wait and see what happens on election day? And you know, it's a noble sentiment. But one reaction to that is that people want to know where the race is. They will create ways of trying to guess it if we don't do scientific polling. The campaigns will leak their own estimates of where it is. Oracles will sit out there and try to look at the sunspots and figure out who's going to win. So I think given the strong need on the part of the average citizen to know, hey, who's ahead, and we know they want to know that, let's have scientific polling rather than just stabs and guesses at it.
The big thing nowadays, of course, is polls of polls, right? You got these, you know, people like Nate Silver who take all these polls, they put them in a formula, and then they come out with their own poll. What are we, the lay public, to do? I mean, how do we get informed opinion when there's so many polling devices out there?
Yeah, that's a great question. Of course, I always say when you have people who aggregate polls for a living, where would they be if we didn't poll, right?
Right.
They would have nothing to put in their aggregation, so they should be very, very thankful rather than critical of the fact that we pollsters are out there braving the winds of scrutiny and actually doing
slings
the polling
and
rather than
yeah.
You know, sitting back in your armchair just waiting for results to come in that you put together. As a scientist, I have to say that it makes some sense to do meta-analysis. Certainly, we do it in health research. We look at a number of different studies. So if it's done correctly, sure, in general, it makes sense.
Yeah. Frank Newport, he's the editor-in-chief at Gallup. Frank, thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
Looks like Amazon's really going to need the $80 I spent there last night. The company reported profits today. Didn't have any. Lost $274 million last quarter. One reason, Amazon said, was big spending on existing and new businesses. Because while we've been shopping, Amazon has been spreading itself way beyond just retailing. From KPLU in Seattle, Ashley Gross has more.
Jamie Nash is a screenwriter outside Baltimore who's been trying to break into Hollywood. He shopped a couple of scripts around there, got some interest, but no sale. Then, ka-ching. Here's a preliminary trailer from For Sale by Superhero, his comedy about an unemployed dad whose new house used to be the home of a superhero.
Who is it? Who's in my house?
This is not your house. This is the Secret Citadel. You are in my house.
Who's the big movie studio behind it? Amazon. Amazon Studios is the company's new movie production arm, and it's optioned everything from horror movies to kids' TV shows. Nash says when he tells friends and family the movie house he's working with, they scratch their heads.
They kind of look at me and they're like, you mean the book people?
You know Amazon, the book people who have laid waste to brick-and-mortar booksellers. But now you've got Amazon in movie production, Amazon in banking, Amazon making tablet computers and running a massive cloud computing system that NASA and Pfizer use. What isn't this company doing? Brian Walker is an analyst with Forrester Research.
Amazon's always been very interested in becoming a utility, a backbone, so pervasive in an industry that you can't imagine it not being there. And it may not necessarily operate on a fat margin, but it's everywhere.
Here's why, says Walker. If Amazon can make a hit TV show, it can lure lots of people to its online streaming and away from Netflix. If it can make loans so merchants sell more stuff through Amazon, the company gets more commissions, plus interest on the loans. If it sells tablet computers, it can sell more ebooks. But come on, no company can do everything perfectly. Amazon is tight-lipped about how these ventures are doing. Walker says Amazon risks spreading itself too thin.
For Amazon, it is a concern that they're getting involved in so many different things. Can they really be good at all of it?
Still, Amazon has a pile of cash and even more ambition. So what do you do if you're a business owner and Amazon is coming after your market, like the world of plumbing supplies?
What was mentioned to me was ABS pipe, which is this black pipe here.
Larry Solomon is showing me stacks of industrial pipe he says one of his customers recently bought from AmazonSupply.com. Solomon is chief executive of Pacific Plumbing Supply in Seattle. He's long competed with Amazon on small things like garbage disposals or faucets. Now Amazon's selling big stuff like pipes and water heaters. Solomon thinks it's going after Home Depot more than a company like his. Still,
we're not at all dismissive of the monster headquartered here in Seattle.
But here's the thing. On the one hand, he calls the company a monster. On the other, he shops on Amazon all the time.
Most recent purchase was I bought my grandson's Halloween costume. He wants to be a policeman.
Can't live with it, can't live without it. Lots of companies have complicated relationships with Amazon these days, and some may be about to. UPS ships millions of orders for Amazon. But Forrester analyst Brian Walker says he wouldn't be surprised to see Amazon start its own shipping business. It already has a fleet of trucks and logistics expertise. Message to Big Brown, watch out. I'm Ashley Gross for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, which begins with the observation that this is the 612th anniversary of the death of Geoffrey Chaucer. He of the Canterbury Tales, yes, but so much more, including this. We learned via the Atlantic Magazine today and the Twitter feed of the Oxford English Dictionary that among the words Chaucer is credited with inventing is Twitter. To utter a succession of light, tremulous notes, the OED says, to chirp continuously. You want to follow me chirping continuously? It's at Kai Rizdahl. You can get us the program at Marketplace APM. Today, the Dow gained 26 points, 0.2%. The NASDAQ inched up 4 points, 0.1%. The S&P 500 also rose 4 points, 0.3% there. John Buckley, Nancy Fargali, Stephen Gregory, George Judson, Jonathan Karp, Sylvester Monroe, Dave Shaw, Betsy Streisand, and Celeste Wesson are the Marketplace editing staff. The acting managing editor is Ethan Lindsay. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us right back here tomorrow. This is APM.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.